See, the challenge of speaking to a foreign audience is that I can't use American humor just because a lot of it is pop culture based and it gets a little lost. And I didn't prepare anything because I really didn't know what the crowd would be like. But we did say that we didn't have any French people here, right? Can we be sure about that? No French people? Huh? Yeah, I probably should. You're absolutely right. It's not a good move. Well, I'll give you an example of a good description of Paris. Who's been to Paris? Okay, would you agree it's a beautiful city? It's like God invented the most beautiful place on earth, and then to even things out, he put French people there. So there's an example. How's that? But that's about as far as I'll get, okay? Especially because they're gonna turn the recorder on in about 3 minutes, and I don't want a record of any of this because, see, I deny it. If somebody says, you told that joke, no, I didn't. Totally deny it. What's interesting is how many Cubans I've met since I've been here. Probably about 5 or 6. I never go anywhere in the world and meet people from the same country that I'm from. But a lot of them migrated to Spain, as I did 43 years ago. And the only difference is I continued and we went to the States. A lot of Cubans actually stayed in Spain. And I met a few that just came 8 or 9 years ago recently, which was interesting. Very different accent we have. All right, let's get going. Recorder's on, buddy? All right. Can you hit the door for me? Oh, there's still people coming in. All right, so we're here to talk about MVVM. I want to take a couple of polls from the audience just to get an idea about what you guys are working on and what you guys are involved in. I try to make my talks very relevant to the things that you can do today, things that you can take home with you and immediately put to use, which is why you'll rarely see me talk about look at this cool stuff that Microsoft's coming out with in 6 months. Because it's cool stuff and we're not going to see it for 6 months. So it's kind of like a tease. You know, it's you get an unnecessary tease because you can't really do anything with it. So what I'm talking about is a pattern here that's used in a number of technologies. Who here is a desktop developer on the desktop platform, WPF? All right, very cool. What about Metro or whatever the heck they're calling it this week on the tablet and phone platform? Anybody work on that? All right, so mostly everybody here was desktop. That's good. Who's gotten some exposure to MVVM before? All right, quite a few, but not everybody, so that's actually good. That means I got something good to teach you. First let me introduce myself, since I speak quite a lot around the U.S. and on occasion abroad. My name is Miguel Castro. Has anybody ever been to any one of my talks before? Oh, all fresh meat, yeah. Very cool. All right, so the reason I ask is because I usually end up offending at least one person in the audience before I leave. But hopefully that won't be the case, and it's usually not intentional. I'm just very blunt about anything that I say, including technology. And with today, with so many things being bombarded, being brought into our lives, you know, between Angular and then the web and the desktop, there's a lot of criticism to go around, and I'm very vocal about that criticism. But I've been doing this for a while. I have I've been on the speaking circuit since 2005, and this is actually my very, very first Tech Ed Europe. I've done 6 tech eds in the U.S., but have never done one of the foreign ones. And a quick shameless plug, I have a couple of Pluralsight courses, and a lot of the stuff that I'm going to show you in today's session is actually implemented in my end-to-end course. So has anybody watched any of these courses before? Very cool. I'm going to ask you a very bold question. Did you like it? You're going to lie to me, because if you didn't like it, you're not going to admit it in front of any of these people. But I hope you enjoyed it, and if you didn't, or if you have any criticism, I'm more than willing to talk to you offline, and we can discuss anything you want. If you would like to get a 30-day Pluralsight trial subscription from me, please email me at the contact info that you'll see at the end of the slides, and I'll be more than happy to send you a code for a 30-day subscription. Now, would you believe me if I told you that code was only good for my course? Let's just say that it is, okay, for our purposes here. So anyway, so we're going to talk about MBBM, which is a really important pattern, and it's not a very trivial pattern. It's important because, unfortunately, when you're dealing with WPF, you're able to do things without it, but that doesn't necessarily make it good. And a lot of people, including myself, that came from the Windows Forms world and migrated to WPF, already had a mindset and a way of thinking about how to do an application. And you carry that over into something like WPF, and you are able to continue that mindset. But it's not necessarily the right thing to do. Whereas implementing a pattern like this makes it the right thing to do because it allows you to exploit the power of WPF that Windows Forms did not have. And that power is in the XAML data binding, which is how I'm going to start. I'm going to give you just a quick brief for, because there were still some hands in here that are not WPF developers. Raise your hands if you're not a XAML developer, if you have not done XAML. Okay, so I'm going to give you a quick, I'm going to spend about 10 minutes on just explaining what the data binding platform is behind XAML. And that segues us into MBBM. That allows me to migrate the conversation into MBBM, and you'll understand why I'm speaking about this topic. So we'll go from data binding to MBBM, and then I'm going to implement the pattern, and I'm going to do some hand coding, and then I'll be adding more things to the demo, and finally show you a finished product where I'm going to go through an exercise. And it's probably one of the best things that I did when I modified this talk a year after I started it, is not only teach you how MBBM works and how to implement the pattern, but literally show you a before and after exercise, a little tiny solution where I do things in a traditional non-MBBM way, and then I do things in the MBBM way. And hopefully you'll see the benefits. This is where I think the value of this talk really shines, in the fact that you'll be able to see the benefit of not doing it and doing it, and you'll see the pluses and minuses there. So let's get going. And wrong button. You got me on two machines here. So all right. So let's talk briefly about data binding. We've had data binding forever, right? It's been around Windows and web. The web was pretending to data bind for the longest time and finally got it right when we started getting all these JavaScript frameworks. But in Windows, it was a little different because Windows had some limited data binding, and it was mainly at the control level. There was really no way of data binding an entire view, an entire Windows form, if you will. And now with XAML, we're actually able to do this. And the reason we're able to do this is because everything in XAML is bindable. And when you ask the question, what is everything bindable to? The answer is it's bindable to everything else. In XAML, you can bind things to an object. You can bind one property to another property in the view. A perfect example of something like this is you can have some text on the screen, and that text has a font size property. Now, you can change that font size property, right? But you could also drop a slider control onto the view. You know what a slider control is? A little control that you can drag with the mouse. And you can take the value property from that slider, and without any code whatsoever, all declarative, you can bind it right to the text font size. And now with zero C# code, I've just given this view the ability to hit the slider, and the font size increases and decreases. So it's a very, very powerful binding subsystem. The power behind the binding is all in this property called the data context. And data context is a property that every tag has. So your binding can start at any level in something called the visual tree, which I'll describe in the next slide. Now, the underlying binding objects are going to follow certain patterns. And these are the patterns that I'm going to describe to you when I start talking about view models and MBBM. One of the characteristics of this pattern is this interface, which I'll explain in detail later. So this is an example of some simple XAML. Now, if you've ever written just a quick application in Visual Studio in WPF, you're familiar with the Windows tag, and under there you usually have a grid or some kind of panel. And under there you may have some controls. These are all just controls. There's always a C# counterpart to window, there's a C# counterpart to grid, a C# counterpart to label. Now, WPF is the X in XAML, it stands for XML. So this is a hierarchical model, okay? Which means visually on the screen, just by looking at the XAML language, it's like looking at XML. It is looking at XML. It immediately tells you what the structure of this view is. So in this particular case, you got a grid inside the window. And inside that grid, you got a label. And WPF is hierarchical like that. I can have, inside the grid, I can have a stack panel. And in that stack panel, I can have other things. And it gets very hierarchical. You're almost able to visualize what this view is going to look like just by looking at the hierarchy of the XAML. Now, here's the power of binding. Every single control or every single tag in WPF has this data context property. And this is the source for binding. This is where I set an object that is going to be made available for binding at any level in the visual tree. This is what I mean by any level in the visual tree. Here you got the screen split up. So I got some XAML at the top and I got some C# at the bottom. Now, I have some XAML that's obviously incomplete, and here I created a regular object that's just a pseudo object, so there's no real code here, and this object contains two properties, name and size. The idea of data context is that when I set the data context to this object, I've just made the properties of that object available for binding from the point that I set it and down the visual tree. So in this case, where did I set data context? I set it to this. This is the top level of the visual tree. So if I'm in a window, it's the window tag. If I'm in a user control, it's the user control tag. And you'll see examples of both throughout the talk. So by setting the myObject variable to the data context of the window, which is this, I've made the contents of myObject, in this case, name and size, I've made it available to anything in the window and down the tree. Do you understand what I mean by the visual tree now? I could have given grid a name, because you don't have to name things in WPF if you don't need to directly address them. Unlike in Windows forms, everything had to have a name. Here in WPF, the name is auto-generated in the background if WPF needs it, but if you need to address the control manually, you can simply add grid, and then you say name equals something, let's say GRD. So once you give it a name, then my code can now say GRD.dataContext equals my object. Now what have I done there? I've given those properties, name and size, I've given them to the grid and everything underneath it. But that also means that anything that is underneath window but outside the grid cannot benefit from this binding. So the most common way of binding, and when I say common, it's 99.9% of the time. When you design applications right, 99.9% of the time, your binding is always going to be at the view level. The idea of this is that you have a view and you have a view model, which is what I'm going to start talking about next. And these are one-to-one correspondence. It's rare that you have a view model that's bound only at a certain level of a view and then another view model that's bound up here. It can happen, but they're very, very specific scenarios, and they introduce complexity in an application that I don't think is necessary, and it becomes much harder to maintain. If you keep things simple and have a view to a view model, your view model, which is in this case represented by this object here with the two properties, will always be bound to the top of the view. And then everything in the view model is made available to the entire view. So this is pretty much XAML data binding in a quick nutshell. It's very, very powerful, very easy. And unlike Windows Forms, where certain properties of certain controls benefit from its binding engine, in XAML, every property benefits from binding. And you'll see how in the syntax later. Well, actually, you're looking at syntax right there. You see how the content property is bound to the name property of the object, and the width attribute is bound to the size property? That's all done with those curly braces and the word binding. So anything can be bound. In this case, I'm binding the content and width. I can bind the font color. I can bind the font size. I can bind the margin. Anything can be driven by an underlying object. So it becomes very, very powerful. And it's all two, if you write your models, your view models right, it's all two-way binding. And the beauty of this is the ability to change something in the view and automatically and almost magically update the object that's underneath it, the binding object beneath the scenes, which in this case we're calling the view model. At the same time, changing properties in the view model should, if you did it right, automatically update the view. Who does web development here? Who uses Angular or Knockout? Either one of the two. Okay, so 2-3 people use Angular. So you guys probably know what I'm talking about already. You're using MVVM. Whether you knew it under that label or not, that's exactly what you're using. In Angular, you're binding, you call it controllers in Angular, which is kind of a stupid name because it's really a view model. But it's an Angular. They're actually changing it in 2.0. They're going to start calling it view models because that's really what they are. But you're changing properties in JavaScript, and the HTML is rendered automatically. The inverse is also correct. You change the HTML, and the view model is changed automatically. So it's a very, very clean separation of concern, and it introduces a lot of benefits, okay? This pattern, MVVM, Model View View Model, was developed. It's actually a Microsoft pattern, but it has its roots from a pattern that's in the Enterprise Pattern Library written by Martin Fowler. Whether he invented the pattern or not, I really have no idea, nor do I wish to argue that with anybody. But the pattern that it's based on comes from his book, and it's called Presentation Model. And Microsoft tweaked it and adjusted it and made it their own for the purposes of binding to XAML. So it stands for Model View View Model, not four words, three. So this last VM should actually be a lowercase m, because the view model is all one word. And this view model class, this is the source for the entire view. This is the binding source. And what it does is that it encapsulates the logic for the view. It's a logical representation of the view. And this is an important statement, because when you're dealing with the physical, you're dealing with things like text boxes, buttons, and list boxes, for example, and labels. And it's hard to think of those visual elements in object-oriented terms, meaning your mind can't really reuse these things. You know, if I have this view with this stuff here, can I inherit this from another one? You can't really do that, because you can't inherit views from another view in WPF. But if you start thinking of your UI in logical terms, these labels become properties. These text boxes become properties. These buttons become behavior methods. So things become a little more logical. And since they're in a C-sharp class, you can start implementing some really cool reusability patterns. Now, I don't get a lot into that, but towards the end of the session, I'm going to show you a slide that'll help you visualize what I'm talking about, and I'll revisit that subject. So, put simply, the view model is a logical representation of the view, where the view is a physical representation. It's loosely coupled to the view. Now, what that means is that at design time, the two really don't know much about each other. And at runtime, the view will know about the view model, but not the other way around. So the view model does not have any visual elements in it. It is strictly C sharp. In fact, in theory, and it's a little more than theory, you can do this in actuality, it just takes a little bit of massaging and work. You can take a view model and reuse it in a DLL with a WPF app, a WinRT app, and if you're still bold, a Silverlight app, or Silverlight for phone, as they're recalling it, rebranding it today. And that single view model can drive those three different views. Now, all of the elements inside those views are different binaries, or different objects. I mean, we're talking about a different framework here, right? WinRT versus .NET 4.5.1. But the stuff inside the view model has nothing to do with the view elements. It's all a logical representation of it. So you'll see what I mean when we get into the code. Wrong machine. So here's an example of where the view model resides in a typical three-tier architecture. Normally, we're used to seeing the view layer, or the UI, as most people just call it, and then you got your business layer, the domain layer, and you got your data access, of course. So the view model sits in between the view and the domain layer. The view model is a UI level layer. It's not a business level layer. I have to say that, even though it may be insulting some people's intelligence, because it almost is common sense when you learn how to do this. But I have seen more than one article written in the past where the author describes a view model as the good place to put business rules and business logic. And that's a really, really bad statement. And it's bad advice, and don't ever do that. And if I find out you do that, I'm just going to get your name and I'm going to blog about you and embarrass the hell out of you throughout my worldwide audience, okay? The view model is a UI level thing. It's got no place for business rules. It addresses the domain layer. It grabs information from the business layer and exposes it to the view. But it is a UI level layer. It does reside side by side with the view. It can be in a different DLL, but it's on the client side of the wall. Now, in a typical simple architecture like this, everything is on one side of the wall. But in an SOA application like this, you got a pretty strong demarcation point. So you got a strong separation between the server side and the client side. Whether you're using WPF or WCF or Web API for services or anything else that you want to use, you got your data layer, your business engines, and your service layer on one machine. And then through some kind of messaging system, in WCF it would be SOAP, and Web API would be REST, You're accessing that information from some kind of client access layer, typically proxy classes if you're using WCF like I usually do. But then obviously you have above that your view model and your view. So once again, reiterating, the view model sits on the UI side of things. It is not down at the business side of things. Any questions so far? By the way, if you have questions, raise your hands. There's a young lady in the back that'll get a microphone to you. You don't have to hold your questions to the end. I prefer that you don't, so your questions can be fresh in your mind. I think we have a gentleman already. Is it turned on? Dude, do it like an American comedian. Go like this. Is this thing on? Hello? There you go.
All right.
All right.
I was just wondering, the first letter, model, is that kind of the domain or service layer, or where is that?
Okay, so I'll talk a little more in detail about that in a minute, but the answer to your question is yes. The M in MVVM is the model. Now, it's actually a good question that you asked, because you just said it, you just asked it in a way that merits a little more conversation. Is it the domain? It really isn't. The view model exposes properties for binding. Sometimes it can expose, and I'll get into more detail now, sometimes it can expose a list of properties in the view model class itself. Sometimes it can expose a single model object that's got properties underneath it. I'm going to show you examples of both. Many times it will be a combination of things, but those are all UI-driven objects. So the answer to that question is that no, they're not. They're model classes that may have properties similar to the business side, but they are not your business objects. Now, depending on your architecture, nothing says that rule can't be flexed a little. In other words, in something like this, there's nothing technically wrong with a domain layer being exposed directly by a view model and then having the view bind to the properties of that domain object. It can happen. I don't do that too much for a number of reasons. The first reason is that there's code that's going to go into the objects that become your model objects that you're going to see in a few minutes. There's code that goes in there that becomes very UI-specific code. It's made for binding, particularly the implementation of iNotify property change. That's typically not something that I want in my business objects, so I tend to keep those separations kind of strict. Now, if you ever get to watch my Pluralsight course, I go through this in detail because I do have a service-oriented architecture like this, and I'm very specific about describing the entities that are on both sides of the wire. And even though they look the same property-wise, these are spiffed up to drive the UI. These are spiffed up to drive the business side. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
And because there's that wall in the middle, you know, I keep them as two separate objects, even though physically they may look very similar. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, so the goals of MVVM is primarily, the first one is to make the view state-driven. Now, I kind of made up this term, but I think it's a pretty cool term because remember, we're on this never-ending quest to put as many words in front of the words driven development as we can possibly find, right? We're going to run out of words in the dictionary, but you notice there's a different driven development every day of the week. Who here does test-driven development? TDD? Do you like it? Do you guys actually have time for anything else in your lives? You do? Really? Wow. Do you have a blog that has that banner that says red, green, refactor, flash, flash, I am test driven? You know which one I'm talking about? See, in America, there's a group of people that have these yellow stickers on the back of their minivans that say baby on board. That's the test driven drivers. If I see a baby on board sticker in America, that's usually a TDD guy if there's a development. But TDD is great. TDD works fine. If it works for your team, I'm not here to talk you out of it. It's a great methodology. I'm just here to tell you it doesn't work for everybody. It certainly doesn't work for me, not because it's bad, but it just doesn't apply to my mindset, to the way that I write applications. But is it working out for your team?
Yes.
Then by all means, continue. As long as you're getting the job done, and at the end of the day, that's all that's important. So what state-driven means is that it's all about changing state in a view model and letting the view redraw itself. Gone are the days where we're manipulating the view directly. This goes for desktop and the web. In the web, we used to use jQuery to manipulate the DOM. We don't do that anymore. If you're still doing that with jQuery, you're a real glutton for punishment, and you're probably losing your hair, and I used to do it a lot. That explains my hair. But I don't do that anymore. I now worry about changing the view model and letting the view just redraw itself. If I develop the view properly, I have to do it only once. And now all the manipulation goes in the view model, and the view automatically refreshes. And the same goes for WPF. This is what I mean by state-driven. Let the view drive its state from the view model, and all you got to do is manipulate the state in the view model, and the view will magically redraw itself, which is very, very nice. Now, MVVM also, it exposes state or model objects, like this gentleman asked earlier, and it also decouples the state and behavior from the view. Now, what I mean by decouples it is that very tightly coupled to a XAML view is something called a XAML code behind. Now, everybody in this room knows the term code behind because it's been kind of plaguing the Microsoft community for the longest time, right? And it has this negative connotation. In the world of Windows, we had no choice. So there was nothing negative about code behind because it was the only way to do things. In web forms, it was the only way to do things. The problem is that web forms just left itself too open for mistakes and people followed really bad practices. And because of that, web forms and its pal, the code behind, got a real negative rap. WPF also has a code behind. And this is where events go. This is where you can change tag properties to have the view changed. But those two things are very tightly coupled together. One does not live without the other. And the main problem here is that the view's code behind class cannot be instantiated on its own. It's not a simple class that you can just say this equals new this from a unit test and then send assertions to it. Very difficult to test. So by using MVVM, we're completely taking all of the state and behavior that would otherwise go in a code behind class, and we're decoupling it into a standalone class, and we're making that class very, very testable. And I'm not going to leave here without showing unit tests on this, because that's one of the selling points of MVVM. As I said earlier, it allows you to think of the UI in logical terms. This allows you to engineer the UI in an object-oriented fashion, which means that one view model can inherit from another. If you have two views that got some similar properties in there, let's say, for example, you have a customer billing view and a customer order history view. Now, those views, you entered those views from a main customer screen that had the customer name and all this stuff, right? Well, you may repeat the customer name in a top label of the customer billing view, and you may repeat the customer name in the top label at the top of the customer order screen. Now, in a view, you really can't inherit one from the other. You gotta, you know, do some trickery with reusable user controls and things like that. But in a logical sense, on a view model, you can easily have a view model for the customer that exposes all the properties that the customer screen's gonna show. Then you can have view models for those other views that inherit from the customer view model, inheriting the properties that it can now repeat on the next view if it wants to, but then adding its own properties. So you can use your imagination and your creativity and develop a lot of different object-oriented patterns with view models that you could not do to views. In most cases, probably 99% of the time, it completely eliminates the code behind class. Now, there are a few exceptions here and there, but they really are very, very small exceptions, and a lot of them can actually be completely eliminated also with some additional help. So if you've ever written a XAML behavior, who's written a XAML behavior before? Blend behavior or attached property? Blend behavior, raise your hand. Attached property? Okay, see, more people have done attached properties because that's built right in. The blend behaviors are awesome, but they require an extra DLL. So those behaviors allow you to extend XAML to do things that you would normally still need to do in the code behind. So really, with the help of behaviors, we can eliminate a lot more from the code behind. And then if you're using dependency injection, you can eliminate eventing. Whereas I used to, and I actually have this gentleman to thank for this because he's the one that went over the pattern with me a couple of years ago, where I was using eventing to throw an event from the view model to the view to throw message boxes on the screen. And now with the help of dependency injection, I use an entirely different pattern. So with some advanced patterns, you can pretty much eliminate any little bit that you left in the code behind. What I want to make sure is that you don't think of the goal of MVVM as I need to get rid of this code behind. Let that naturally happen. Otherwise, you're going to get stuck. Once again, the view model should have no knowledge of the view, and it should be loosely coupled, usually at runtime. There is a way to couple it at design time, and I usually do that only for demos, but I try to avoid that. So I'm going to skip this. It's too verbose of a slide, and I'm going to jump right into some code that's going to demo everything that I've talked about so far. Okay, so let me switch over. Any questions so far? Nope. Okay. All right, let me show you I'm going to do a quick view model here, and I'm going to write a couple of properties. This is a class called Superhero View Model, okay? And I'm going to add two properties to this, one called name and one called secret identity. Now, I'm doing this without a model class. So in this case, the M in my MVVM is embedded right into the VM, okay? I'm literally going to expose two properties here like this. Now, what I want to do here is that I want to take this class and bind it to something. So I've written a view, and the view's already done. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of mundane typing. And as you can see, the view's got a couple of labels and a couple of text boxes, and I'll make sure that I blow it up when I run that so the top is a little bigger for you. If you look down here, where these text boxes are defined, you'll notice that I'm binding to a property called name and a property called secret identity. Now, all I got to do is fill that object with something and get it to there. So let's try that. Now, something's broken here. Am I? Oh, sure am. I kind of like that red underlying thing they do in Solution Explorer now, except that sometimes one error can cause a chain reaction of 1,500 others, and all of a sudden your Solution Explorer is red. You notice that? All right, so here's what I'm going to do. This view is called Superhero View, and the view model is called Superhero View Model. I want to get you used to a very common practice right away, and that is a one-to-one, view model to a view. The view model drives the view, and I usually have one-to-one, and I also name them accordingly. I name all my views with a suffix of the word view, and all my view models with the exact same name, but the suffix is the word view model. Now, what I'm going to do here is that I am going to create this superhero view model, and I'm going to add some values to those properties. So the name is going to be, there we go, Iron Man. Is Iron Man two words or one? Who cares? And the secret identity is, it's not really secret, right? Because his most famous phrase is, I am Iron Man, right? What's the guy's name? Come on, nerds. All right. Tony Stark, my hero. All right. So we got Iron Man, we got Tony Stark. Now look what I'm doing next. I just finished building this object, and the next thing that I'm doing is that I'm taking the view variable, which is an instance of superhero view, and I'm setting the data context. As simple as that. By me setting the data context, I just bound this view model at the top level of that view. Now, the reason I did it with a couple of extra steps here is to show you what the most common practice is here, and that is instead of using Windows, you use user controls. And you'll understand why I'm using user controls. Toward the end of the session, I'm gonna talk about view flipping and a view model first approach, and it'll make more sense why I'm using user controls. But this window right here, this is the code behind for the main window, the startup window in the application. Look what this window looks like. See, I'm in Spain and I'm forgetting my English. So it's nothing more than an empty window with this content control in there. And in that content control, that placeholder, I'm setting the content property to that view. We've been able to do this for a long time. What you're going to see at the end of the session is a little different, because here, what is view? Is view a view or view model, the view variable? It's a view, right? It's a physical view. And that's what you see me setting in content, which means common sense dictates that in that content placeholder, that whole superhero view form is going to be put in there. And that's exactly what's going to happen. But at the end of the session, I'm going to show you how you can put an object in there, an actual view model. And I'll show you how to do mappings so it knows what view to grab. But we'll get to that in a minute. Let's run this real quick and see what happens. That's what's going to happen. Why? Because this is code. Code fails. So what broke? You see anything broken? Is that a Visual Studio, like stupid Visual Studio trick? Yeah, but I tried compiling and it's actually telling me three failed. Am I missing something here? What happens when Visual Studio goes retarded on you? You stop it and you start it again, right? That's like pulling the plug on the computer, right? Is anybody here familiar with a British TV show called The IT Crowd? Is that like the single best show ever to show go on TV? I love that. And the guy's got the guy's on tech support, and he's got a recorder that automatically answers his phone, and it says, "Hello, IT." Then it pauses for about 5 seconds, and then it says, "Have you tried turning it off and on again?" Then it pauses for 3 seconds, and it says, "Okay, thank you," and it hangs up. And then he just goes off to lunch, and he just plays this recorder on there. Okay, there we go. You see what I mean? I'm not imagining things, right? It did give me three items failed, correct? See, it's one of those stupid things. But now, you see how the binding works, okay? Now, according to what I told you, as far as data binding and that context variable is concerned, I can take this view right here and give this grid a name, like GRD. And then in that piece of code where I said this.dataContext equals view model, I can say grid.dataContext, because everything in XAML has a data context, even a stack panel, even a label. Why would a label have a data context? Well, because a label can actually contain other things inside of it. So remember, whatever you set the data, whatever data context you set the view model to, that's where your binding power starts, and then down the visual tree. That's why the most common thing is to set it at the top level, which is what I did with this line of code, view.dataContext. What is view? View is superhero view. There is superhero view. That would make this the this variable, or the view variable. And now I'm able to use that view model all the way down the line. Now, let's build this view model. Let's build a little more out of it. And we're doing good on time. We're fine. All right. What I need to do is that I need to spread this out a little bit, okay? So let me open up these properties. And let me open up this one. Now, the reason that I opened up these properties is because this view is very, very simple. But the problem is that it doesn't have true two-way binding, okay? If the view changes, yes, I'll get it back in my view model. But if the view model changes, there is nothing to alert the view that the view model has changed. Remember what I said about state-driven? You want to do it state-driven. You want to do it where if you want this view model to be adjusted, you can make this view to be adjusted. You want to change the view model content and then have the view receive a message of some kind that says, oh, something just changed in my binding. Let me refresh that binding. And right now, we have none of that. All of that comes into play with an interface called iNotify property changed, which is in system component model. There it is right there. And the only thing that this has is an event called property changed. And the typical pattern that we do, because what happens here is that when I bind a view model to the view, when that data context equals gets executed, the view will look at the underlying binding object. And it will check to see if it implements this interface. Now, if it doesn't, it says, I got nothing else to do. I'm going to try to work as best as possible, but don't expect magic. But if it sees that the object implements iNotify property change, it wires itself to this event. By it wiring itself to this event, now I've given myself the power within the view model of raising this event. And when I raise this event, this is my way of notifying the view that something has changed. And what I got to raise the event with is information about what property changed. And all I really care about is the name of the property. So the easy way to do this is to usually have a method called onPropertyChanged that looks like this. And it does your usual if this property change not equal null. You know, you always want to check an event for null before you raise it. And now I'm going to go ahead and raise this event. And the event args here is called property changed event args, and it needs the property name. That's what the IntelliSense is telling me right here. So now that I have a helper method, what I can do is inside here, I can check to see if this value has truly changed. So if it has truly changed, I'm going to go ahead and reset my backing store variable. And after I do that, I'm going to make a call to onPropertyChanged and tell it which one has changed. Visual Studio is not cooperating with me today. So let me do the same thing on the secret identity. And then I'll go through the workflow one more time. So this is the usual pattern that we follow in embedded view model properties or model properties that you're going to see in the next example. Because most of the time, I may not want secret identity and name to be embedded right into the superhero view model, because I may have other uses for these two properties elsewhere. I want to keep this in an object, a separate object, maybe an object called superhero model. And then the view model can just expose the superhero view model. And inside the properties of the model, I would still do the same thing. Because when those properties get changed in the view model through code, I need to be able to alert the view that the name property has changed. By me raising this event, the view, which is right here, says, hey, I just got a message that the name property got changed. Let me look down my visual tree and see if anything is bound to the name property. And it starts doing a top-to-bottom search, and it sees this. And as soon as it sees that, it refreshes it. So without that onProperty change, we don't get a refresh of that view. So changes to the view model do not update the view. So this pattern is very, very important. It's so important that the more common practice is to do something like this. I'm going to comment that out. I'm going to get rid of this. And I'm going to uncomment this. So it's very, very common to have a base class to put all this in and kind of start building your framework that way. And if I go into my base class, you'll notice that it implements iNotifyPropertyChange. I don't have anything else in here right now, but it's always good to have a base class for all your model objects, so then you can start adding common things to it, and that's how you get your framework built. This makes sense so far? Now let me show you an example of a separate model object to a view model. Yes, sir? Hang on 1 second so the lady can bring the microphone to you. I know I can hear you fine from here, but it's being recorded, so you got to speak into the mic.
I was just wondering, when you pass the property name as a string, it seems there's a potential there.
Yeah, the potential for problems, right?
Yeah, so is there a way to expose the name without passing it just as a string?
There are tricks. No, in a real-world scenario, I would probably not want to pass it as a string. I want another alternative. There's a couple of alternatives on there. I don't have it for you here, but if you see me after the talk, even if you don't want to watch my course, I'll be more than happy to point you to the framework that I use in my course. I have it for free on GitHub, and that framework actually uses a little lambda expression trick. So using lambda expressions and reflection, my model object looks, my view model would look like this instead. You understand? And by doing that, now obviously it's breaking now because I don't have that capability built into it. But by doing this, I have the ability to strongly type that, because the only thing that I can send into that lambda expression is a property inside the very model. So if it doesn't exist, it's going to break at compile time. So you get the compiler check with this technique that you don't get with strings. And you're right, if you use strings, is it prone to error? Absolutely, especially when you type and spell like I do. You know, it's going to be a problem. There's just no way around that.
So sorry to interrupt, but there's one more way.
There's another way. There's a new way, I know.
That version is really good if you know the name of the property. It's the same, different property names. So you can basically raise the notified property chain for other properties. If you need to. But if you just want to do your own property name, there is actually a new attribute in .NET 4.5.1,
I think. It's called caller
member name that you can add. So you can actually infer the property name for you automatically.
Yeah, so I've seen this technique, and it's brand new in 4.5.1, so yep. It wasn't even around in 4.5, which is when I wrote this talk. So there is, yeah, look up, I guess what you want to look up is caller member name. So write it down, you're not writing it down. It's called caller member name, and it's an attribute technique that is even better than the Lambda one. So yeah, definitely anything but strings, right? But you got to crawl before you walk, so I need to teach it with string just so you understand what's going on behind the scenes. All right, any questions so far? Any other questions? Yes.
The way that you raise your event, it seems it isn't thread safe. Is it a good practice to do that?
If you raise the event, I've never run into a threading issue. Tell me what your threading concerns are.
You have two lines of code. If it's not null, and then you raise it. If at the middle of two lines, you have another thread that will change the state. Mm-hmm. Let's say it wasn't null, and now it is null.
Yep.
When you raise it, it will be null, and your if won't work.
If you have that kind of multi-threading going on, then the best thing to do is probably to put a lock statement around that setting.
You can only raise that event from the UI thread, otherwise you get a thread access exception.
Oh, you could only raise that event from the UI thread. That's a good point.
You can marshal for not having the mic, but you have to marshal the thread. The raiser of that event has to be the UI thread, because the only one that's allowed to touch the UI is the UI thread, so you need to get it back to the UI thread before raising it.
Yeah, so wherever you spin off another thread, you're going to do some marshaling before you get to this point.
Okay.
Now, how are you doing your marshaling? I know it's a little bit off topic, but I'm curious about how do you do your marshal. Do you use invoke?
I'm a WinForms user, so.
Okay, yes. But you use WinForm, but that's fine. But you use WinForms 2.0 and higher, right? Because if you're using 1.1, everybody in this room is going to laugh at you. But you are using 2.0 and higher in WinForms. Are you using invoke?
Yes, invoke is okay, invoke so, required. Yes.
So I'm going to give you completely off topic, just something to think about. Look up synchronization context. Synchronization context is a much better and cleaner way of marshaling, because synchronization context is an object that's available to you at WinForms, and it's also available in DBPF, but it lets you grab onto the UI execution context and execute any code you want using either an anonymous delegate or a Lambda expression. And that code will be executed on the UI execution context. And it does essentially the same as invoke, just a cleaner programming model. So look into synchronization context, and I think you'll like it. It's been around since 2.0, and 5% of developers out there even know that it exists, which is really, really weird. I don't think Microsoft did a good job of promoting it or pushing this new feature that's already, since 2003, 2004? So synchronization context, look it up.
Thanks.
You got it. All right, let's take a look at another one here. I'm gonna come back out to the code behind, and I'm going to hook up another view model that I have before we get into the next topic. This one is called character view. So let's take a look at character view model, which is obviously broken. Why is it broken? Huh? Oh, you're right. I uncommented the wrong thing. There we go. All right, so I got character view and character view model. Let's take a look at character view model. Look at the difference here. I got a boatload of properties that I want to expose now. You're going to see it in a second, but I'm exposing them as one property. This property is simply called model, but you can call it anything you want. And this property is of type character. Now, I'm cheating, obviously. I'm not going out to a database to get a character. I'm just kind of creating it in a hard-coded way here in the constructor. But just suspend disbelief. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, like we say in the States. Everybody understand that reference, right? The man behind the curtain? All right. What if I were to say these are not the droids you're looking for? Everybody understand that? Just want to make sure we're on the same pop culture level here, okay, guys? This is Star Wars we're talking about. All right. Let's go over to common and go to character. Look what character has. Whole boatload of stuff, right? We got name. We got powers. We got arch enemy, hero, secret identity. But I'm exposing them all as one object in the view model. However, the property change notification still has to take place, which is why I'm doing it here. As you can see, there's my on property change. Now, back to this first gentleman's question that he asked 15 minutes ago, okay, about is this the same as the domain object? Now you're seeing an example of why I said no, it is not. Because this on property change is UI specific things. The server side is not going to really benefit from this. Now, does it hurt to have property change notification in your domain or business objects? Technologically speaking, it doesn't hurt, but I'm a big hater of dead code, code that's not going to be used. So if my layer is never going to be using this, I probably just don't want to have it there. That's the cleanliness that I want to follow in my code. So this model object, despite the fact that it looks like a domain object because it's an object with some properties, it's still a UI layer object. It's still something that is going to be used for the sole purpose of driving the user interface. There's all my properties. And there's my little create static method. Now, I'm going to introduce you to something else. Observable collection. Everybody here has used collections before. You've used lists, you've used hash table, all of that stuff. So observable collection is a generic-based collection, very similar to list. The difference is that it is observable, as the name implies, which means when I take this property called powers and I bind it to something in the view, now the view has wired itself into an event that is inside observable collection. That event comes from an interface that you don't have to concern yourself with, but I'll tell you what it is anyway. It's called iNotifyCollectionChanged. And that interface allows you to define, it basically defines events that the observable collection is gonna raise when things are added or removed in it. So now when the view automatically binds itself to those events, the view will get notification when you modify those collections. So adding a power will automatically increase the visual list that is bound to the powers collection. We've done this in, who was the Angular people in here? There was like two people that raised their hands with Angular. So you've done this before when you bind ng-repeat. You're familiar with ng-repeat, of course, right? You're not familiar with ng-repeat? Knockout, okay, knockout is data bind for each. Same exact thing. So in Angular, you got ng-repeat, knockout is for each inside the data bind colon. When you say for each, you're bound to in knockout, it's actually called ko.observable, observable array, where in Angular, it doesn't matter. It's just a JavaScript array. But the concept is the same. Your manipulation of that array will automatically cause the view to refresh. And that's what observable collection does. Let's take a look at the view that's on the other side of this. Character view. So this character view, look what it looks like. I have comic character name, secret identity. Is he a good guy or a bad guy? Remember that was a Boolean variable? We got powers and archenemy. Now let's take a look at the XAML behind here. So this label right here, well, these are just my labels. Here's my first text box. Look what it's bound to. In the previous example, you saw me bind something to the name property, and that's because the name property resided right inside the view model. But now the view model contains a model object, which in turn has all the properties underneath it. So there's no rocket science here. I'm just going to model.powers, model.this, model.that. It's as simple as that. Pretty straightforward. The problem is that you don't get type safety here, and there's no way around that. So if you misspell anything here, you're just going to have problems, and you're going to have to deal with them. Huh? You can what? You can get type safety? Explain. Sorry.
So there's a way to set up what's called a design time view model. So basically you can create another object that mimics the way that your model is going to look, and it will give you type safety while you take.
Let me explain in detail what Chris is talking about, because it's not a requirement, but it's always a really good idea. What a design time view model is, and we've had this in the web control. I used to be heavy in the web forms web control world, and we've had this in the past, where you're developing a grid, right? And your grid is designed. It's very easy to see a label text box, label text box, label text box in design mode. But then if you have a grid that's got like powers at design time, that's going to show up as just an empty grid. Or if it's a list box, it's going to be totally empty, right? It's not going to fill until you run the application. By providing your application with something called a design time view model, you're almost giving it kind of a temporary view model with some dummy data just for the purposes of the designer. So you have something visual to show in the designer. You understand? And if you add these capabilities, you then add some type safety to this that you would otherwise not have until you run the application later. So good point. But it's design time view models are definitely an advanced thing. Chris actually used to do a great presentation just on design time view model stuff. And what the heck happened to that, man? Oh, I know what happened. I know exactly what happened. The same thing that happened to this one. Everybody all of a sudden thought WPF was dead, right? Is that what it was? You ever notice that the minute Microsoft stops talking about a technology, the community interprets it as dying? And I'm here to tell you that's not true. I mean, we all know WPF is alive and strong, and it's back in full force because they put the team back together and they're coming out with 5.0. So it's actually being worked on some more. Somebody else I thought had raised their hands? Nope? Okay, cool. Now, take a look at here. This text box is being bound to model.name. This text box is being bound to secret identity. There's hero. And down there, there's arch enemy. The secret, the is good guy. Where's the is good guy? Wasn't that a check? Here it is, checkbox. Hero. If it's a hero, yes or no. So what am I binding to? I'm not binding to the text. I'm binding to is checked. That variable in the view model, hero, was a Boolean variable. And the Boolean variable is capable of binding to the is checked. Why? Because the value of is checked is also Boolean. Now, what happens if you have a property on the view side and a different type on the view model side? And you need to get those two together. Does that sound like a possibility that somebody may have and a need that somebody may have in here? It comes up all the time, people, all the time. Here, I'll give you a perfect example. Visible. Does it make sense that visible is true or false? Is visible a true or false value in WPF? Nope. Why? Because somebody decided to do true, false, another, right? So we got visible, we got collapse, and we got hidden. So we have to use something called a converter. And I'll show you that at the end, because I do have one for you. Now, this other thing here, remember the powers? The powers was a collection, observable collection of power. So all I did here is draw a list box, and now I'm defining the data template. That's the beauty of WPF. Gone are the days in Windows where in Windows Forms you have a list box that could only show these items. Now, the way a single item in a list box looks like can be anything you want and in any shape and direction that you want. I'm making it a simple item, but this could be a complex form that then gets repeated X number of times in the list box. That's the beauty of WPF. And that complex form is drawn inside the data template. So my data template is a very simple label on line 32. That can be 50 lines long if I needed to. And all those 50 lines are repeated X number of times. And the stuff that they're bound to inside the data template is a single iteration of the underlying object. So in this case, the list box is bound to the powers collection. Powers collection was a power object, and that power object had a description property, which is why you see description in line 32. So that complex object in the collection can have a bunch of other properties, and all of them can be used to custom draw what would be a single list box item. And that single list box item will get redrawn X number of times depending on how many powers there are. And if I run this application right now, you'll see the results. Just like that. Now you see three powers in that list box. But to reiterate the importance of what Chris brought up with design time view models, that list box looks really good right now. But look what it looks like at design time when I don't have a design time view model. It just looks like a text box, really. Not only is it empty, it's very deceiving because it doesn't look like a true list box. So when you start getting into complex list boxes, the design time view model becomes significantly more important. But it's a topic for another time, because it's very complex. Anyway, any questions? Because I'm going to move on to something else. So far, you've seen state, the ability to change state, have it shown in the view. Now we're going to talk about the other side of things, which is behavior. Behavior is what a user is going to interact with. And that's where a job gets hard, right? Because if it wasn't for users, we'd all have really easy jobs. But are there any questions? All right, cool. OK, 10 minutes for commands and 10 minutes for the exercise. I'm on another machine. Sorry. OK, so commanding is how we handle behaviors in MVVM. And commanding, at the heart of commanding, is this class that we call a command class. And a command class is an implementation of an interface called iCommand. And a command class which implements iCommand can be bound to any control that implements an interface called iCommandSource. Now, the only important thing you need to take out of that second statement is that the two main things that you're ever going to work with that implement iCommandSource, at least 90% of the time, are buttons and hyperlinks. Buttons and hyperlinks implement iCommandSource. By implementing iCommandSource, they have an additional two properties that other controls do not have. Those properties are the command and the command parameter. I'll go over command parameter later. I'm going to go over command now. And this command class is what provides some kind of execution. This is what will happen when this actionable control, like a button or a hyperlink, will get pressed. So let me show you some basics of this, and then we're going to take it up a notch. And I'm going to show you three levels of the command class. The first one is very, very simple. This is the command. This is a very simple command class right here. This is an implementation of the iCommand interface. And you got three things that you want to worry about. And all three are important. The first one, and the most important one, is the execute method. This is what's going to happen when this command gets fired. And something on the UI is going to trigger this command. But this is what's going to happen. Now, here I'm doing something very stupid and very unrealistic. I'm taking the easy instructor way out by using a message box, which you know is the biggest no-no in the world. But just to show you that this took place, it's an easy thing for me to show. I'm going to show you the character was saved. The hard part is that this command has no knowledge of any character. How the hell is it going to know what superhero we're talking about? We'll get to that later. The other part of a command is this Boolean method called canExecute. This is the determining factor to whether this command can execute or not. And this Boolean this method returns a Boolean. Both of these things, execute and can execute, are going to be bindable members on the view. So think about this. They're bindable, which means when I click the button, I want the execute to fire. So that's going to bind to something. Whether or not the execute can fire is determined by a Boolean member. So you can do whatever you want with this. A very logical thing to do is to bind canExecute to the isEnabled of a button. If the button cannot fire, it will be disabled automatically. Now, how does the view know to constantly call upon canExecute? Hey, is it time for me to? Is it safe for me to press this button? Yes or not? True or false? Can I execute this command? Well, this is where this event canExecute change takes place. And by itself, canExecute change. You're kind of on your own to fire it. And there's all sorts of advanced patterns and techniques for firing this event. But more often than not, you won't have to. If you do things the simple way, and I try to do the simple thing 99% of the time, what you want to do is you want to have the event declared, because you obviously have to. And what happens is that when this command gets bound to a control, like a button, for example, or a hyperlink, that control is going to wire itself to this event. OK? Now, when the control wires itself to the event, sure, it's going to receive a message when the event is fired. But in my case, I'm never going to fire this event myself. So what I'm concerned about is just that initial wiring, which is why you saw I did a long version of the event code with an add and remove. Because when the control wires itself to my can execute changed, I want to take the control and wire it into the command manager's requery suggested. The command manager is something that works in the background, kind of like the garbage collector. And it's just as complex. and the command manager will automatically query when it thinks it needs to. In fact, I'm not going to worry about it now, but you notice I put this debug write line in here? So this will show you how many times it gets, and it's a boatload of times. It's that whenever it says, I think something took place in the view, let me re-query the can executes, it does so. And you know, what the real formula is for when it does it, it's one of those mysteries of the universe, right? I think it depends on the phase of the moon and the tides and stuff like that. But the fact that it works is enough for me to just leave it alone and that's it. When the button wires itself into the can execute changed, I in turn am wiring the button into the command manager. So now, whenever the command manager fires its requery suggested, it's going to include a requery of my button. And the can execute up here is going to get requeried. Now let me show you how this gets wired into a view. So here's a small view. You just saw this already, same exact view. But now I got a save button here. And look how the save button is being wired. The save button has a static resource. Now, real quickly, without not getting into a lot of detail, all a static resource is the XAML's way of instantiating a class. So up here at the top of the XAML, I set up the static resource by saying, take that class, save command, and instantiate it and call it this. And then down here, I can bind to that. And what I've accomplished there is that now when I say command basics, and by the way, I'm going to stay in the code. When I press this now, look what happens. Character was saved. So the command was fired. Okay? But the problem here, and this is, I'm taking it up a notch now, is that this command has no knowledge of the view model. So we need to get information about that view model into the command so the command knows how to save the current character. Because normally what you would do here is maybe make a call to a business object or data access or maybe a service call to save your superhero, right? So we need to let this command know about the view model. And there's a couple of ways of doing that. And which one you use depends on your reusability needs. This is a popular one. This one allows the save command to be reused because it's a separate class, but it's one I'm not really fond of because you still have to couple it to the view model somehow. As you can see, excuse me, I'm inserting the view model into the command constructor here, and then in the execute, I'm showing you that a certain character was changed, as you can see, viewModel.model.name, and in the can execute, I'm making sure that it's not empty. Because if the name property of that model is empty, that can execute's going to return a false. And if I'm bound to something, like if the save button is enabled, is bound to the can execute, it should disappear, which is what I'm going to show you now. But the problem that I have with this is that I'm really tightly coupled to this. And if I'm going to be this tightly coupled to one specific view model, I'd rather encapsulate all of this in the view model itself. And I'll show you how to do that. But if I do have the need to reuse this code in two or three view models, I could always pull out a commonality in those two or three view models as an interface and then use the interface to inject into the command. That's just abstracting one layer down. My usual technique is not that, but let me run this real quick and show you exactly what I'm doing here because I'm going to bring up the view. And in the save button of the view, you'll notice that I don't have static resource anymore. Now it's just a simple property, no different than model.name or model.power. It's just a property of the view model called save command. So let's go to the view model and see what we're doing in the view model. As you can see, the save command is just a public property. Where is it? Where's it declared? Oh, there it is. This should go here, sorry. So as you can see, I'm just declaring a property. There's a property of my view model now called save command, which is of type of that command. And when I instantiate that property right here, I'm sending the view model in. And that's how I'm coupling the two. Make sense so far? Okay. Let's run this and see what happens. I can hit save, and it says character saved, and I'm running the wrong program. Let's run the right project right here. I'm going to say save. It says Superman character saved. Watch what happens if I change this. As you can see, we got the right information now. Now, remember that can execute? That can execute gets reevaluated whenever the command manager thinks something in the view changed enough for it to be requeried. Watch what happens when I make this text box empty. See what happened to the button? The button disabled itself. Why did the button disable itself? If I go into the view, you'll notice that that button is not only bound to the command property, but it's also, actually, it doesn't need to. Once you don't have to worry about the isEnabled. By binding it to the command property, it knows to disable that button. It does the same thing with the hyperlink. But the property is at your disposal if you want to use it for anything else. So what's the better way of doing this? The better way of doing this is with something called a delegate or a relay command pattern, okay? That's the one that I like to use if I can most of the time. And what this does is that it allows me to create a command of type delegate command. Now, this is an object that I'm going to let you look at on your own time. It's in the little framework that I have in here, so it's in the common class. And all it does is it's just an object that implements iCommand. So if it implements iCommand, it's got a execute and it's got a can execute. But what it does in the can execute and execute is execute functions that I send in when I create it. It just invokes functions. They're delegate types. So by implementing this pattern, what I've done is that I allow you to create a property called saveCommand2 of type delegate command. And in those two constructor arguments, I can send to it functions that are going to be the execute and the can execute. And those functions are right in my view model. There they are right there. There's the save command execute, and there's a save command can execute. And now I have the execution and the execution determination built right into my view model using this delegate command pattern. And the end result is the same. If I change this now to save command 2, and by the way, you notice that I was able to bind the content of the button to save command.label, because I actually put a label property inside that delegate command, so I can actually set it here. Where's the view model? Right here. That's being put into the label property. So this gives you a great way of localization where you can go to a resource file to get different language localization. So if I run this now, we're going to get the same thing. Hit save. And as you can see, we got the information. And what got executed is inside this view model right here. Look at the execute right here. Hit save, that's what got called. And you got everything nicely packaged in your view model. You got your state and you got your behavior, all nice in the view model. Make sense? All right, so let's go back out to the slides, and I got one last thing to show you, and I don't want to run out of time and not show you this. And we got 5 minutes, which should be okay. Okay, so what I want you to do is that I want you to think in state-driven terms, okay? And the way you think in state-driven terms is by asking yourself a simple question. If you have a view and that view has a requirement, the question is, the answer is, what state, the question you should ask is, what state and behavior in your view model needs to change or be exposed in order to satisfy that requirement? So what I'm going to have is a little exercise here where I'm going to provide a view with a label to be displayed in one of two colors. I'm going to have two buttons that alters the colors of the label, as simple as that. And based on the current color of the label, I'm going to enable or disable the buttons appropriately. So if I have it red and a green, and I press red, the label should show in red, but now the red button should disable. And the green button should show. And the minute I press that, it should turn to green, and the button enabling and disabling should flip. Follow me? Now I'm going to show you this, and I want to properly unit test. So the before and after here is going to show you a lot of code behind. And the second one is going to go the MVVM route. Let's jump to the code and see what that looks like. I And by the way, all of this code is available for you, as well as the slides. And if you have any problem downloading it, or you know it's not the same, or whatever, just feel free to shoot me an email or a tweet, and I'll make sure that you get it, OK? All right, so here's the before and after exercise. And what I want to show you is the before view. So the before view looks like this. As you can see, it's got the two color buttons, it's got the content, and it's got a whole bunch of stuff. Very simple things, right? But let's look at the code behind here, because this is the traditional way. This is what WinForm developers would be using, right? You got what happens when the control is loaded, so the initial state. You got what happens when each color button is clicked, so you got two click events. And in each one of the methods, the helper methods for each one of the events, I'm changing the color of the label, and I'm swapping the enabling of the buttons. Make sense? It can't get any simpler than that, right? But how the hell would I test something like this? Plus, it's also ugly. It's that kind of code that you feel like, you guys ever write code and you want to go home and take a shower? We've all written code like that, right? Usually it's not ours, it's somebody else's, right? At least that's what I like to tell myself. So if I were to do this the MDVM way, this is what I'm looking at. I'm looking at writing a view model to expose the state and behavior for what I want. So I've exposed everything in properties here. I got a caption called label caption. I got the two captions for the color buttons, color one and color two. And then I got a command for the change color command. And the change color command has an execute and a can execute. And look what it's doing. The execute is setting content color to an argument that I'm sending in. Now, remember that command property that I'm binding for the button? There's also a command parameter property that you can use for an argument that gets sent into these two methods here on line 40 and line 45. So I'm going to send the word red and the word green is. Why am I going to send the word as a string? Because this is a view model. It should have no knowledge of specific view objects like brushes. We don't want that. We want to use a simple string and somehow convert it, which I'll get to in a second. So by me sending the word green into the one button, it's going to execute. Did I say, hey, Siri? Stop it. All right. So by me sending the word red into the execute, it's going to set content color to red. By sending the word green, it's going to send content color to green. Then the can execute is checking to see what its content color set to, and returning a true or false accordingly. Let's go over to the view and see what that looks like. So in the view, my button, the content, which is the text, is set to those properties, color one caption, color two caption, and the command is set to, both of them are set to the change color command. So both are going to fire the same command, but one of them is going to send the word green to it, one's going to send the word red to it. Now, what is the word red and green being used for back in the view model? To set this property here called content color, which happens to be a string. So what the heck is content color? Let's go to the label here, the content label, and you can see that the foreground, which is the color of the foreground, is set to this color called content color. But foreground is a view attribute, and it's a type of a brush. It's not a string. So we need a way to convert that red and green string to an actual brush color. And that's where a converter comes in. So I have a string to color converter that I wrote. And that string to color converter basically says, take whatever the string was that came in and convert it to this solid color brush thing. This is how you do conversions of true and false in visibility to a visible.hidden or a visible.collapse. You can convert anything to anything. You can have a one and a zero that converts to something a lot more complicated. So this is the way that I did this in MDVM. And if I look at the code behind for the after view, remember, this is the code behind for the before view. This is the code behind for the after view. And the beauty of this is that now I can write a unit test here. And I know I'm running out of time. Here's a unit test that tests that view model. It instantiates the view model and tests property change notification. It tests the execution of the commands to make sure by sending something into a command, I'm getting the right result in the content color. And you can run all these tests. In fact, I can just run all these tests right now. And you can't do that if all this code is in the code behind. And there, all my tests passed. And if I set this as a startup project and run it. There's the difference. And I didn't do anything with the enabling. It handled, the command handled that automatically. I did the value conversion for the string to a color, and I kept everything nice and packaged inside the view model, and it's completely 100% testable. So it's much more cleaner design, much better separation of concerns, and I can save myself on the shower. I can take a shower for an entirely different set of reasons later, not because I wrote bad code. Make sense? All right, guys, I am out of time, I'm afraid, and I don't have time to do a proper wrap-up, but I'm going to just jump real quick to the last slide here just to give you something to think about. I gave you a little example of what a framework would look like, and if you want to see me offline, we can talk further about it. There's some MVVM frameworks out there for you to work with already. I like to write my own stuff, do my things my own way. But think about this seriously. Think about the decoupledness that it follows. Think about the testability and the reusability you get from view models. And it's totally worth it to take the time up to set MVVM up and to do a view model and a view one-to-one correspondence to do it right. And in my opinion, no exceptions. Every view has a view model. I don't combine the two. One view has events. Another view has view models. It's just code becomes really unmanageable at that point. I'm out of time, I'm afraid. If you want to talk to me more about this, I'm at your disposal for the rest of the day, okay? So thanks for coming, and I hope you enjoyed yourself. I'm going to be talking about dependency injection on Thursday at 5 o'clock, so hope you come see me again.